This is The Guardian.
Was ist noch besser als ein guter Plan? Die Möglichkeit, ihn zu ändern. Mit integrierter KI bietet Workday kontinuierliche Innovationen, die Ihnen helfen, agil zu bleiben, egal was passiert. Workday, the finance and HR system for a changing world.
Hey, Michael Zafi here.
And I'm Helen Pitt from The Guardian's Today in Focus podcast.
Now, with campaigns from the Democrats and Republicans in full swing, the eyes of the world are turning to the US.
And Today in Focus is going to be in America with deep dives from the swing states every week.
Plus, there'll be a daily update from me, Lucy Hoff, bringing you the latest news from the campaign trail in this pivotal race to the White House.
Join us for Today in Focus every weekday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we start, we're talking about assisted dying today, so there are references to distressing physical suffering, suicide, and death. This week, the UK may have begun one of the most significant social changes in recent memory. It's literally a matter of life and death, and at this point, everything rests on the shoulders of one MP, Kim Leadbeater, whose private member's bill on assisted dying may soon become law.
This is a huge issue, and I do feel the pressure of that, but actually, why are we in politics? Why am I in politics? I want to try and help people, and I want to change things for the better.
This week's episode begins with our interview with her. But is Parliament really equipped to make such a huge decision? And what if it sooner or later opens the way to the kind of legalised euthanasia that a lot of people fear? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. Assisted dying, it seems to me, is a really complicated issue, and I'm not sure that the way this country does politics is well suited to it. It's too rushed, there isn't enough room for deep thought, it excludes more people than it includes, and everything tends to become divided and polarised. So the most obvious thing for me to do was to take some of those concerns to Kim Leadbeater herself, and then have a conversation with one of this debate's most long-standing voices, who also happens to be a Guardian columnist. I spoke to Kim on Tuesday afternoon, the day before she introduced her bill to the House of Commons. Kim Leadbeater, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. First of all, can you briefly outline what will and won't be in your bill in terms of how it'll define who's eligible for an assisted death and so on?
So the initial first reading of the bill will take place tomorrow. And what will happen there is I will present the short title and the long title of the bill. And then after that, there'll be a period of a number of weeks up until the 29th of November when the second reading and the big debate about the bill will take place. But the detail of the bill will be put together in the coming weeks prior to that second reading date.
Is it likely to be built around the idea that someone will become eligible to make the choice of assisted death if they are terminally ill with 6 months to live or less?
It will absolutely be based around terminal illness only. And I've done a lot of research into that, and I appreciate that some people would like a bill that went further, and I also appreciate that other people wouldn't like this bill to exist at all. But I think the research that I've done shows that clearly there is a need for the law to change. The law as it stands is not fit for purpose, and we've got terminally ill people, unfortunately, who are taking their own lives, are going to other countries, including Switzerland, having to find lots of money to do so, often going on their own before they might necessarily need to go, and potentially missing out on weeks and months of life, or having pretty horrible deaths because palliative care doesn't work for everybody. Palliative care is a really important part of this argument, and we need brilliant palliative care, and many places have brilliant palliative care. I think the thing for me is in the coming weeks, it's about having that broad, compassionate, robust debate. But what I am clear about, John, is that this is for terminally ill people.
Okay. Some of what is being proposed here unsettles me, partly because of the way that you're proposing that it's done. I worry this might be too rushed a way of doing it. This is a very, very big decision. It will make society morally different in a small but extremely significant way. And I wonder whether we ought to involve as many people as we can beyond people in Parliament in feeding into that decision and the discussion about it. I mean, when Ireland, for example, changed its law on abortion, they had a citizens' assembly. We could have a royal commission. You know, the idea that MPs and peers are going to be the only ones on quite a brisk timetable to have anything to say about this, And then oversee its passage into law troubles me somewhat. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, I would push back on that, really, in the respect that this is a debate that's been going on for decades. It's been going on in Parliament for the last 20 years at least, and the rest, but there hasn't been a vote on this issue for nearly 10 years. And in terms of having as many voices heard as possible, that is absolutely the approach I am taking to the bill. But also, other MPs, Lords, are having lots of meetings, lots of conversations with lots of different organisations and individuals who are affected by the law as it stands.
Yeah, but that's ad hoc, isn't it? I'm talking about something formal and structural that's accountable and whose sort of decision-making we can see, right?
Well, I mean, there have been citizens' juries on this subject. There was one quite recently that was done. There's been others over the years. And I think actually that, you know, there's a Westminster Hall debate that took place in April, I think, of this year it was. There was another in 2022. All that information is out there in the public domain. And that was informed by consultation with lots of different organisations. And I think, you know, just for reassurance, I mean, for example, I had a meeting yesterday with the British Medical Association. I've had a meeting with Hospice UK. I intend to meet with as many different organisations and groups as possible. And that will be transparent, that will be out in the open, there's no secrets here. And again, as I say, I think that narrative that it's been rushed through, I would push back on that because it's not a new subject. You know, this subject has been out there for a long time. Various polls have been done. We've had lots of campaigns by different newspapers and famous people have been involved. So it's not as though this has suddenly come to the table.
Yeah, I would like a few more ordinary people to be involved as well as famous people.
These are ordinary people. So literally, I did an event in Parliament last week with about 20 different families who have literally talked me through their stories. These are very normal, ordinary people. Bear in mind, you know, I know MPs sometimes are perceived as being ordinary, but some of us are quite normal. But you know, so I had 20 families in. The stories they told me about their loved ones who have taken their own lives under the worst possible circumstances, the stories about very, very painful deaths. I had a man who lost his wife. He'd been married 50 years and he got to a point she was in intolerable pain through this terminal illness and the palliative care wasn't working anymore. And he actually said, I almost wanted to take a pillow and end her life for her. And he was absolutely distraught and devastated. And this is the reality that people are going through. Others who, you know, one gentleman, he's a police officer actually, and his mum went to Switzerland to Dignitas. He had to say goodbye to her in the street because if he'd gone with her, he could potentially be implicated as anybody can be. So he's waving her down the street in a taxi to the airport. You know, so these are normal people. This is not politicians that I'm speaking to, believe me. And I spend a lot of time in the real world having these conversations with people who are affected by these issues.
Okay. As and when this legislation goes on the statute book, there's also a conversation about what may happen in the wake of it, right? Which is that you'll then get voices who want the law to go further, right? Now, if you look at what, you'll know this, if you look at what's happened in Canada, for example, not only did the number of people who were taking the assisted dying option go up hugely between 2016 and 2022, it started at 1,000 in a given year, and by 2022 it was 13,000. There's now a debate in Canada about expanding the law on assisted dying to include people with chronic mental illness. Now, obviously, that's not in the original legislation, but once you put this principle in law and therefore in society, you inevitably have no control over where it goes next in 5, 10, 15 years.
No, but I think the advantage we've got in this country is we can look at what's happened in other countries and take what we might view as the best practice, but also what we wouldn't want to happen. I'm very clear, we would not approach this in the way that Canada have approached it.
Sure, you are, but there are other people who would quite like to see it go that way.
No, and that's why it's so important that we get the legislation right, and that's why it's so important that the robust process that I'm talking about in the coming weeks really plays out with a fully informed debate, speaking to experts, speaking to medical professionals, speaking to lawyers, speaking to judges, making sure that this is a piece of robust legislation which creates actually a safe environment than we've got at the moment, because at the moment no one knows what's going on. You know, 600 people with terminal illnesses take their own lives every year. We have no idea what's going on in those circumstances. Right. We have no idea whether they've been influenced by other people. We just don't know. So what I actually hope is that by having a robust legal process in place, it will make things safer for people. And also, you know, the important word is choice. No one's saying that anybody has to do this if they don't want to do it. And I've spoken to family members. I've spoken to people in my constituency about it. It's having that choice. I actually don't know what I would do I've no idea what
I'm doing. No one makes choices solely as an individual. There are all sorts of pressures and people's sense of obligation and not want to worry and burden people and so on, you know. The idea that anyone makes a solely individual rational choice is very rarely true.
Right? Well, like, you could say the same about anything, though, couldn't you?
But this is as serious as it gets, right?
Yeah, but ultimately, it would be the individual who signs up to be part of this. It would be their choice. You're absolutely right. They might be influenced by other things. But you know, the robust safeguards that would be in place through medical supervision, through judicial supervision, would mean that, you know, people are putting checks and balances in a way that they're just not doing at the moment.
Okay. What do you think of this? We both know, because it's part of the reason why your party is now in government, that the NHS and social care and hospices are all in a pretty awful mess, right? You don't have to try very hard when you go online to find financial appeals by hospices who feel they're close to being on their knees, right? Before you fix those problems, how can we have a conversation about assisted dying? Because the danger there is, well, people will take that option for fear of their last months alive happening in a broken down NHS and an awful social care system and a system of hospices that's on its knees. So hadn't we better sort those out before we take this next step?
Yeah, look, there's no two ways about it. We have got serious issues within our healthcare system, and we've been very open and acknowledged that. And we absolutely do need to fix those issues. But it's not an either or. This is about giving choice to people. And people might choose to stay within the NHS. They might choose to stay with palliative care. That's absolutely fine. But some people will not want to do that, and they'll want to make a different choice.
Oh yeah, but aren't their options restricted by what a mess the NHS is in? You see what I mean?
No. Well, no, I disagree, because ultimately, we have also got brilliant palliative care, and we've got brilliant service within the NHS. We've got fantastic healthcare professionals who are doing this work day in and day out. But the reality is, for some people, that will not ease their pain and their suffering. I met with another family, exactly the same situation. Someone had got an incurable cancer, and there was nothing they could do to treat that patient anymore. They were doing their very best, but there was nothing they could do. And also I met with a woman who was actually allergic to opioids, so she can't have pain relief.
Oh, no, and in those cases, they're much clearer. But how do you guard against somebody who's given, say, a year or 6 months to live, and because they well know that the NHS is in a broken-down state, would rather take the assisted dying option than be cared for? Now, the answer to that, to my mind, if they're not at the kind of extremes that you're talking about, is to fix the NHS so that's not such a dreadful prospect.
Well, I mean, you absolutely need to fix the NHS. That is a given. That is absolutely a given. But I do think we are conflating that issue too much with the option of choice for people who are at the end of their life. And, you know, these people just don't have that choice at the moment. And it's not about, you know, again, another woman I spoke to last week, she's got terminal breast cancer, stage 4. She's watched what will happen to her at the end of her life because she's worked with other patients and other people who've been through it. And she just does not want that to be her end. She wants a different choice and a different option. So I just think it's putting that choice, that autonomy, at the heart of this conversation.
Okay, two last questions. This one goes back to that question, looking beyond this legislation being passed and where things might go subsequently. You must have spoken to, I hope you have anyway, a lot of disabled people. And you'll know the centre of gravity among many disabled people, opinion-wise, is that they're really unsettled and worried by this. And they think it points to a future that quite reasonably causes them a lot of anxiety. What do you say to them?
I would say to anybody from the disabled community, I will be a voice for you in champion your equal rights and the fact that you deserve exactly the same treatment as anybody else in society. And let's have that campaign and let's have that conversation. But that is not what this bill is about. This bill is about terminally ill people with a diagnosis that their life is going to come to an end in a relatively short space of time. So it would not be about people with disabilities whatsoever. But what I'm conscious of is that we are taking the rights away from other people, terminally ill people who want to choose this option. And I just think, let's fight for disabled rights, and I'm happy to be part of that conversation, but let's not conflate that issue with people who are terminally ill and want the choice.
Okay, last question. Here you are. You are positioned right at the tipping point of a huge social and moral issue, which, as you say, has been being discussed and debated for decades, right? Very soon, if your bill goes through successfully, we could move, as I've said, from being one kind of society to another, right? In an important respect, anyway. Morally and philosophically, that's an enormous thing to have to think about and be positioned where you are on. What does it feel like?
It's pretty intense, to be honest. But do you know what? If I'm being totally honest, I didn't set out to be an MP. I've ended up in this job for, you know, the worst possible reasons in some respects, but I'm here to try and make a difference. And this is a huge issue. And I do feel the pressure of that. But actually, why are we in politics? Why am I in politics? I want to try and help people and I want to change things for the better. And when you have spoken to the families that I've spoken to, who have been through, in many cases, the most horrendous situations with loved ones losing their lives, I think I have a duty to stand up for them. But I also think, John, that I've got a duty to facilitate this debate in a compassionate and respectful way. So all the points that you've raised are absolutely valid and they're a really important part of this debate and this conversation. So my duty, and it is a heavy duty, and I do feel that, believe me, is to make sure I can do this in the right way. And that's my role and responsibility.
If this all works out, you will be part of a historic line of backbench MPs, as you'll know, who have been instrumental in these huge social changes. Sidney Silverman and hanging, David Steele and abortion, right? I mean, it's in that trajectory. And we often miss that backbench MPs have been centrally involved or responsible for these great changes. But that's quite a mantle, isn't it? It's a significant thing.
It is. It's huge. And I do feel that. But, you know, again, sort of building on what I said before, I've been an MP now for 3 years, but I came into this job with a very unique identity. And I'm acutely aware of that every day with lots of the debates that go on, you know. But I was always driven by trying to do the right thing. And I do believe this is the right thing to do. So I will continue for as long as I can to try and make a difference in whatever way I can. But you're right. So thanks for increasing the pressure a bit there.
Yeah, sorry. It can't be helped. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim. Okay, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, I'll be getting even further towards the core of this debate with The Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee.
Hey, Michael Safi here.
And I'm Helen Pitt from the Guardian's Today in Focus podcast.
Now, with campaigns from the Democrats and Republicans in full swing, the eyes of the world are turning to the US.
And Today in Focus is going to be in America with deep dives from the swing states every week.
Plus, there'll be a daily update from me, Lucy Hoff, bringing you the latest news from the campaign trail in this pivotal race to the White House.
Join us for Today in Focus every weekday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Joining me now is Polly Toynbee, the Guardian columnist who's been writing about assisted dying for a long time. And I should also say, Polly, that you are patron of the campaign group My Death, My Decision and vice president of Humanists UK, which might give the people listening some idea of where you sit on this subject. Thank you for being here.
Hello.
Tell me, first of all, why you feel and have felt for such a long time that assisted dying of some kind, this kind of change, is the right thing for us to do.
Everybody's afraid of dying to some extent, but I think what really frightens people is how you die. The idea of exiting through a torture chamber quite needlessly. And when you're going to die and when you've had enough, you should be able to say enough is enough and end your life faster. And I've seen my mother die horribly, wonderful woman, and she had cancer of the liver and bowel, and she had very good palliative care. They came in, you know, three times a day. They did everything they could. And morphia is not a nice drug. You think, I might float away on a lovely haze of drugs. It's not like that. It's quite nasty. And so I saw her die, and she begged the GP. She said, can't you do anything? Can't you give me more? And he said, since Harold Shipman, we can't anymore. We used to. I'm told, he said, we used to, but now they count every single ampule of every possibly lethal drug, and it's too dangerous.
Okay, and you have you had a close friend,
yes,
former senior journalist at The Guardian, who died in such a way, again, that kind of heightened your sense that this is the right thing to do.
Yes, a very different case, more difficult, probably won't be covered by this legislation. Jill Tweedy, wonderful writer, tremendous feminist, very funny, very clever. She had motor neurone disease and she'd seen her father die of it, so she knew what was coming, which is that you get more and more paralysed and eventually you die through slow asphyxiation. And she, being a very organised person, managed to acquire enough pills, which she was told if she took together would be lethal, and booked herself in for a respite care to a clinic and took these pills there. And the clinic just said it was natural causes. But it was a way of ending her life neatly. But sadly, because none of us said goodbye, she didn't say goodbye to her children.
She had to do it as a matter of subterfuge.
Absolutely. She had to wait till her husband had gone out. She never told anyone. I was going around to see her that day. And she just did it quietly on her own. But tragically, nobody should have to die alone.
I have never had experiences like that, although I have watched family members who are terminally ill die and friends similarly. I'm not sure I necessarily fall hard on one side or the other. I think ultimately we probably agree, certainly about the legislation that's being proposed, but I have lots of sort of worries and fears about it. And I wonder whether there are complexities to this which aren't being talked about enough. One of my concerns is about the fact that this has suddenly arrived on the political agenda in the form of Kim Leadbeater's private member's bill. And it seems very rushed to me. I mean, it's being debated in the House of Commons this week. The second reading and debate will be on November 29th. We spoke to Kim Leadbeater earlier, and she said she's speaking to lots of people about this, and that's a good thing, obviously. The same presumably applies to a lot of MPs, but none of those conversations are public. The rest of us don't get to hear them or find out who those people are. Keir Starmer said he's pleased he could keep his vow to Dame Esther Ranson, the former TV host who's dying of lung cancer. He could keep the promise he made to her to make time for a debate and vote. But I also wonder why she has so much clout here. You could answer questions like that by having a citizens' assembly, like they had in Ireland before the law on abortion was changed. Instead, we're arguably rushing this through Parliament, which includes the House of Lords, let's not forget, which means that lots of people don't have a say, but because the House of Lords does, Ian Botham and Evgeny Lebedev do. There are lots of... You're laughing, but that's true, unavoidably. It might get botched in all sorts of ways, many of which even you might not like. It's not just that it might offend people who are against this. It might get botched in a way that people who are for it don't like. It's not a great way to do it.
It's been debated over and over and over again for years. Bill after bill has come through, has failed, hasn't been given time. Private members' bills don't get through unless you have a government that's willing to give it time. Free vote, but time. And, you know, Charlie Falconer has put it up several times. It's been up lots of times before. You cannot say this hasn't been debated when it's all over the press, the newspapers, television programmes. It's something people want to talk about because whichever side of the argument they're on, people feel pretty strongly about it mostly.
But it's not been debated in the sense that the government has said, right, we think now is the time to make this change. Now let's have a proper, ordered, public, accountable debate on it, which is what happened in Ireland with abortion. And maybe that's the best way to manage these kind of social changes.
Well, I think in Ireland, there was, you know, such a long tradition of the dominance of the Catholic Church being against divorce, against abortion. It just seemed socially necessary. In this country, for many years, for decades now, the majority of the public in every opinion poll has been in favour of assisted dying. People understand very well. People have seen what's happened to people in their families, and they know they want the choice. After all, not very many people will probably make use of this, but every single one of us can be assured that if we are facing a horrible death, we have that power ourselves.
Okay.
And I think that's what's so important, is it's for all of us, not for the small number of people who will actually use it.
Okay. That's an interesting juncture on which to talk about the next subject, the idea that a relatively small number of people will actually use it. Because the debate should be partly about them, but it should also be partly about what a change like this might sort of trigger in all sorts of wider senses. Kim Leadbeater's bill seems relatively clear and watertight, if it survives in the form that it's in at the moment. It wants to establish the principle in law that people facing certain death from terminal illness who are likely to be in the midst of obvious suffering, if they're a specified time away from their predicted death, those people should have the option of assisted suicide. But like all social changes, if this goes through, it may well introduce other ideas and principles into the culture beyond the provisions of this bill. I mean, that's just in the nature of the way that societies tend to work. One change could be that what some people see as incurable suffering will increasingly be talked about as a legitimate reason for assisted suicide. Or if people look to their future and it seems hopeless and painful and they won't get the care they need, maybe this will be seen as the sort of answer that ought to be considered. Another idea this change might strengthen is that if people feel they're a burden on their family or friends or the NHS, assisted dying may be something they ought to consider. Now, you'd have to legislate for those things, but ideas like that might be about to take a big step forward. Do you worry about that?
I think slippery slopes with legislation like this is a very, very bad philosophical position. You couldn't move to anybody who was under intolerable pain or suffering without changing the law. And then we would have this debate all over again. It would have to pass through both houses.
No, it doesn't
mean
it won't happen.
It might happen. If it happens, it'll be because people want it. It will always be because the people of Air First. Every single liberalisation we've had, whether it's been abortion or divorce or theatre censorship or all the things that previous Labour governments brought in, always trailed miles behind public opinion. I mean, the government is very slow, drags its heels on these issues. People are out there first.
So if public opinion moved further than Kim Leadbeater's bill, sooner or later, you think that's something that we'd have to respect and then perhaps have a debate about a wider definition of assisted dying? If that's
yes.
where the
I think so. I think somebody would put up another bill. It might happen. I think it's unlikely. I mean, in Oregon, where it works very well, they've had the same law for 40 years without changing it, and nobody's suggesting changing it.
Yeah, but there are countries around the world that have wider definitions of assisted dying. Incurable suffering comes into play rather than terminal illness. And I think that's perhaps where this starts to get dicey. In Canada, for example, there is a debate now about whether qualifying for assisted dying should include mental illness. Now, it's not on the statute book in Canada yet, right? But that's being discussed. Those things unsettle me.
Well, I think you can discuss those things, whether they pass the law or not. I don't know. Everybody keeps referring to Canada and what it might do. I suspect they won't actually do that because, you know, that really is a very different step and a very different kind of issue. Though others would argue, you don't understand that mental health causes as much or more suffering than physical pain.
Whoa. So you think that's worth considering?
The
argument.
I understand the argument.
Suicide.
I don't think we'll do it. I don't think we should do it. But, you know, it's worth discussing those things because there is always a suggestion, well, mental health, they could just pull themselves together, can't they? Whereas somebody who has suffered for decades from incurable, appalling depression, but I'm not for that. I'm not for that. But I'm simply saying these things can be talked about. Nothing will change unless the law changes.
That sounds a bit like a slippery slope to me.
Well, everything's a slippery slope.
Not everything's
somewhere.
A slippery slope.
Yes, it is.
I think when it comes to questions of death, one should worry a bit more about a slippery slope.
Of course.
Anyway.
And I'm pretty sure that this bill goes through, it will be either 1 year, 9 months or 6 months.
Right.
And Kim Leadbeater herself tends to say she wants it to be 6 months. In which case, you then have to think about proportionality. Supposing there's a risk that one or two people, for wrong reasons, have the last few months of their lives curtailed, who shouldn't perhaps have. You balance that against the certainty. The palliative care people have produced a horrific report. The sorts of things people never talk about. What actually can happen to you at the end
sure,
of your life.
Sure.
In that report, people are vomiting their own feces. Their body is open and stinking because their body is rotting and people can't even go into the room. It smells so bad. I mean, about 17 cases a day are that sort of disgusting death. Now, we all hoped, God, it doesn't happen to us. And we want to know that we could stop it if it did.
Yeah.
So you have to weigh up one risk against another certainty.
Of course.
The certainty is that horrible deaths are happening that shouldn't happen.
But equally, the concern of people like me would be that people who take the option of assisted dying will extend far beyond people with the sort of awful, extreme, unbearable terminal illnesses that you're talking about. You wrote a comment piece recently in which you said this: people will feel pressured to die for fear of being a burden, exclamation mark, as if to sort of bat that away. And you said, in my view, saving children from your lingering bad death is a good reason to depart before your life becomes unbearable to you and awful for them to watch and remember. Now, there's a lot going on in those words, right? And I wonder, aside from pain, what might make a death bad and a life unbearable? It's not just things about the person themselves and their condition, their illness. It might be a broken NHS or poor social care or hospices on their knees. And I think that consideration might come into the argument about this bill. Some people say, before we go down the road to assisted dying, we should fix those things first.
Well, of course we should. And there's no campaigner, including Kim Leadbeater, who doesn't feel passionately that we should have better palliative care, yeah, better social care. Of course. And also, it doesn't always work. My mother had plenty. We had all of us around her. She had good palliative care. It doesn't relieve the longing to be out of pain and out of humiliation. I mean, being a burden isn't just I feel sorry for my children. It's I don't want my children to remember me in this terrible state and to be agonized by it themselves. It's my feeling about being a burden. It's not so much
concern for them. No, but it's inevitably colored by your relationships and other people's views of what their life ought to involve. You see, we arguably live in a much more superficial, selfish age than we used to, where people have ideas about living their best life and all of this stuff.
Oh, I don't think we live in a more... I think everybody thinks we're on a downward road to hell in a handcart.
Let me finish the point. And therefore, the idea of caring for a close relative or friend when they're in the midst of illness is anathema to a lot of people. They can't cope with it. And therefore, perhaps, whether directly or indirectly, people might feel that and think, well, they're not going to look after me. Maybe assisted dying is the right thing for me to do.
I'm astonished.
That's an awful prospect.
I'm astonished to hear you produce this sort of Daily Mail view of the world where we're always going to hell in a handcuff. We are morally worse.
You're not going to get one over on me by bringing up the Daily Mail.
We are useless. We are hopeless.
No, I didn't say that.
You said that this generation is more frivolous.
No, I didn't say that. I said all of us are.
All of us.
This is the decline of the extended family and so on. We have less of a sense of obligation to our family and friends, perhaps, than we used to.
I do not think we are in a state of moral decline. I really don't.
But tell me why I'm wrong about this point, that perhaps pressure could be brought to bear on someone who was suffering and terminally ill by people who did not like the idea of caring for them and watching them die, and therefore they might encourage them to take this option. And why that? I mean, that worries me.
They might. On the whole, I see people caring very well, even for parents they don't much like. I see a lot of it, a sense of responsibility within a family, very strong. But if they did, all right, let's assume that some people did that awful thing and said, Mum, it's time you went.
Or the mum would say, I don't want you to have to deal with this, and therefore I'm going to go. Now, there are many more things involved in an exchange like that than one person's illness and condition, right?
Yep, but we're talking here about losing the last 2-3 months of your life?
At the moment.
Well, it isn't going to change unless we are back here in the studio discussing a new law, and we begin all over again with some other law. We're talking about the law that is on the table today.
Okay.
And let's stick to that.
So presumably you disagree with Wes Streeting, the health secretary, who in July said, is palliative care in this country good enough so that choice would be a real choice or people would end their lives sooner than they wish because palliative care, end-of-life care, isn't as good as it could be? You disagree with that point.
I'm very glad to hear a health secretary say that. I'm really pleased to hear him say that because, of course, we want palliative care to be better.
No, but as a reason to doubt this bill and what it might let loose, you disagree with that?
We'll see which way he goes when the time comes. But I think as health secretary, you might feel you want to abstain on this in case people think, oh, he's trying to get rid of all the bed blockers, isn't he? I mean, I could see he's in a different moral position where there's an awful lot of money at stake in the NHS if he thought he could bump off the inconvenient. So it might be reassuring to us all to hear him having his qualms about it.
What about all those voices of disabled people who are very anxious about this? Where do they sort of sit in your field?
Well, it's interesting because there are disabled people on both sides. I mean, the other side can put up their battalions of people in wheelchairs as well to say, no, we want the right. We know what's tolerable and what isn't. Other people don't know on our behalf. I think there will always be people of every kind on both sides of this argument. But the point is, overwhelmingly, the public is on my side of the argument.
But where the public are or aren't is one consideration here. But one can have a conversation about morals that doesn't necessarily involve where public opinion is. And public opinion used to be, and probably still is to some degree, overwhelmingly in favour of hanging, but it doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
That's true, that's true. But I don't know how you pass a law without having pretty much public support for it.
But Tanny Gray Thompson, for example, the disability activist, former Paralympic athlete, has said, I'm really worried that disabled people, because of the cost of health and social care, that choice is then taken away. So the only choice they have is to end their lives, which comes back to the idea that these questions about the state of public services and social care and so on are involved in this argument and might distort the debate and the morals of it in all sorts of ways.
She must be one of the fittest people in a wheelchair and not mercifully close to death. But I do understand why the disability campaigners should use this, because they're quite right that, you know, treatment for every kind of disability is appalling. I mean, the benefits are appalling, the care is appalling. You know, they're right. And if they say, oh, well, they're going to kill us off because they can't be bothered to pay for us, I understand why they should use that argument. But I don't think it's a good one in this case, because I don't think anybody is going to knock them off in the last few months of their life.
No, but they fear that this legislation, albeit as watertight and safe as it seems, opens the way further down the line for those changes to happen.
Well, everything might open the way towards something else. But again, it's not going to happen unless we change the law again. And as I say, in most countries, I mean, Canada's an outlier. All these other countries, you know, Switzerland, Belgium, Holland, have had it for years. They haven't changed their law.
Not along the Leadbeater lines. Some of those countries accept incurable suffering, in quote marks.
Rarely.
Some of them do.
Some do, but it's rare. Most of these are along the lines of...
And isn't that your position, that you would, that in the fullness of time, you'd quite like to extend the provisions of assisted dying to include incurable?
Well, let's see how it goes, first of all. Let's see. But I do think people, you know, I'm a humanist. I think life is all we have. We should live it to the full and to the best. And when it feels no longer sufferable because of unendurable pain and suffering, we should be allowed to end it. But I do not think that's going to be the law. And I think the law will be, as I say, either 1 year, 6 months, 9 months before death. And I very much doubt that it'll be any more liberal than that.
Let's move on to things we probably agree on. One of the strongest arguments for this, it seems to me, is that assisted dying goes on and has been going on anyway for a long time, but it does so in a way which holds nobody to account. It all tends to go on secretly and so on. And this is a very good way of ensuring we know what's going on, and therefore we sort of minimize damage to people and some of these awful eventualities that we've discussed happening under the radar.
I think there probably is a lot more murder than anyone knows. I think husbands and wives kill each other more often than anyone knows.
But in the case of your friend Jill Tweedy, for example, that illustrates why this is best brought out into the open, doesn't it? In the sense that she secretly had to take her own life, right?
Yes.
Whereas in the future that this bill arguably opens up, one would be free in public to make that decision and then plan accordingly in the full knowledge of everybody that you knew.
Say goodbye to everybody, organise your death the way you want it. The idea of travelling to Switzerland, you have to have a lot of money, so it's only available to the relatively wealthy. Travelling to Switzerland to a grim death room where thousands have died before you and drink down a potion all alone, or maybe with a brave relative who still risks, despite Keir Starmer having eased that when he was Director of Public Prosecutions, you still could be at least questioned by the police, is desperately lonely and sad. You know, I don't want to die in some Swiss clinic. People want to die in their own home, surrounded by their children and their friends. And I think that's a right you should have.
So what's your gut sense of whether this will succeed and emerge from the legislative process in the form that Kim Leadbeater and you would like?
I think it will succeed. I think it will probably go through at the minimalist 6 months. I would like it to be 9 months or a year, but I think it probably will. And it will go through with great public approval too.
Okay. Thank you for joining us today, Polly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I hope you found today's episode thought-provoking. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. Before you go, I want to highlight the Guardian's Football Weekly podcast, which this week is speaking to George Dowell, the owner and director of Worthing FC, who bought the club with the compensation money he received when his own football playing career was ended by a serious car crash in 2010, which left him paralysed from the chest down. It's an incredible story and a must listen. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
Hi there, Jonathan Friedland here, columnist at The Guardian and host of our Politics Weekly America podcast. I want to ask for your help. Guardian podcasts depend on the support of you, our listeners, to help fund coverage, especially in years like this one. We don't have a billionaire owner or shareholders holding the purse strings, which is how we stay independent. To support The Guardian, just click the link in the episode description. And once again, thank you.
This is The Guardian.
Hello, it's Grace Dent here. We have a new season of comfort eating ready for you to devour. I sat down with Hollywood royalty Stanley Tucci, who came to tell me the secret ingredient in his favourite British food, the humble cottage pie.
No American has ever been able to say that.
New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.